Today is Thursday. It is November 29th, 2018. It's 11:21 in the morning. This is John Williams, and we're the Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record each week in the studios of WGN Radio. Listen for me weekdays on that radio station, weekdays from 1 to 3, and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. Steve Bertrand.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch, and I'm running for alderman in the 14th Ward.
Maybe an opening.
Patty Vasquez, you can find me Monday through Friday, 7 to 11 p.m., unless there's a sporting event, in which case I'll be on afterwards until 1 a.m.
I'm Scott Stannis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune, creator of the comic strip Prickly City, and host of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN+.
I'm Eric Zorn, the positively giddy columnist from the Tribune. I run three times a week, and you can find me online and in print.
As we record this, we've just received a bulletin that Alderman Ed Burke's offices are being raided by the feds. I understand they're literally putting brown paper up over his windows.
Yeah, we learned about it first from City Hall. Reporters there, and he has a glass door and glass windows in the office, and they put like postal paper or shipping paper. They papered over the
so
you can't see what the investigators are doing on the inside.
I think they're unplugging computers right now.
I don't know what they're doing.
It's their December to Remember event. They're going to put a big bow on the paper.
But they're doing it as well at the alderman's office on the southwest side. So
does everybody,
it's not just at City Hall.
Think that, I mean, what's up here?
I'm assuming they also are locking everything down so that the spray tan stuff doesn't leak out, because
wow,
that can be incredibly toxic.
Wow. Are we already doing that? Are we already dumping and dismissing the guy? I mean, all we know is that there's brown paper up on his windows.
Well, I was just surprised. Is this the first time he's been raided by the FBI? I don't know.
Does anybody have a guess as to what this is about exactly? Because I frankly don't.
Here's the explanation.
It's not an explanation. This is completely irresponsible. There might be some. It might not be wholly
perfect for a podcast.
It might not be wholly irrational. But we were arguing over this. I don't think it merits a newscast mention. But Michael Cohen was in court today pleading guilty. Ed Burke did legal work for the Trump Organization in fighting the tax assessments right at Trump Tower.
Oh, right.
But you know what? You could go to any client that his law firm has worked for.
That's an answer. You know, in a time, maybe by the time you are listening to this, we will all know much more than we do now. That's almost certain. But I'll say this. A takeaway for me right now, I said this to Steve before we jumped on, is term limits. If you leave a Chicago alderman in office long enough, poop will happen.
Do you know how long he's been there? Since 1969. He is head of the Finance Committee and controls the city's purse strings. Of course there's something.
If everybody is angry at Madigan all the time for the power he wields by virtue of him being in office, this is the same thing.
It's the same construct. The guy works as a city councilman in the morning. That afternoon, he goes to his law firm and helps people fix their tax bills.
You're right. Yep. That is even a dicier situation.
Yeah, I've always liked Ed Burke, though.
He always has interesting ideas. Often has interesting ideas, right?
So he's seen as a competent, respectful, reasonable.
He's, you know, a Chicago historian.
Oh, tremendous
certainly.
Historian.
He has some kind of wacky. I mean, he was the one who wanted to outlaw driverless cars. I don't agree with everything he does, but I think he's been an interesting character.
He has a little of the Bert Notaris in him, right? Diapers on horses.
Yeah, he's
and
like
so
the respectable.
Who was it that wanted to ban foie gras in the city? Was that Notaris?
No, that came from the 50th Ward, didn't it? Or from
Moore?
Jure Moore, I think, yeah.
I'm going to keep track.
Listen, while we're talking about the city of Chicago, Bill Daley, Richard's son, Richie's brother, is running for mayor, and he said this week at the City Club that to pay down the pension obligations, he would consider legalizing recreational marijuana, casino revenue, new or higher real estate and transfer taxes, and a commuter tax. A commuter tax, explained Bill Rutherford in the Tribune, would be levied on the wages of people who work in Chicago but don't live in Chicago. I don't hate this idea because I live in Chicago. But Steve,
and you barely work in Chicago.
Wow.
2 hours a day.
Right. Ouch.
It's a full
right.
show.
Ouch.
But I'm not sure the city's in a position of strength here. You do not live in the city, so if this were to go into effect, either your employer or you would have to pay for the privilege.
Well, I think one of the things we'll know or remember the Emanuel administration for was bringing suburban workers back to downtown. And so this would be quite a welcome, a sleight of hand when they did it. I benefit from the city of Chicago. I love the city of Chicago. I'm willing to do my part, but I think I do.
How?
in the takeout tax and different taxes, sales taxes, different things I pay here.
Parking,
I think
you pay for parking, probably.
But you don't pay a property tax. Not in Chicago.
No, I don't pay a property tax, but I pay different sales taxes. I mean, I do. I don't live here. I don't benefit from those big lunches
you go to after your show every day.
Right, the martinis.
Well, the point is, what I think you're saying, Steve, it's about the fact that we know, but we need the money, and you come downtown every day. You should help us out.
Maybe I could see a commuter tax in one way or another. I'm not sure. I mean, it would be unfair to do it just to Metro riders or things like that. I don't like the idea of it.
The stories I read, and I'm not an expert on this by any means, but that is not going to stop me from weighing in here. And what I have read about this is that the places where they have done this or tried it, Philadelphia, Detroit, Cleveland, I think, are the cities in the U.S. that are doing it, among the cities in the U.S. doing it, and it doesn't seem to work very well. It doesn't juice business. It doesn't boost the bottom line. And that's really, I mean, to me, I mean, just about any tax, you can argue about its morality, but the question is it going to be effective? Is it going to do what it is that you want it to do and not do what you don't want it to do? This doesn't seem that promising.
This is his brother's idea, right? Rich Daley used to say, yeah, they come in, you come to the beaches in Chicago. You know, they used to talk about that all the time, the suburbanites coming in.
But the last thing this city needs, honest to God, is another tax. I mean, Rahm spent the last two terms looking for, if he could tax the O in oxygen, he would have done it. Mm-hmm. And he tried. And this is just another example of a city run amok, badly run, financially bankrupt, with bonds near junk, CPS is at junk, without addressing at all the idea that how can we cut back? How can we cut? Can we cut?
And to Eric's point about whether or not it's even going to work if it hasn't worked anywhere else, I also don't see any reason to build more ill will with the suburbs. I just think that, you know, this is a relationship.
Or to tempt a business just like Cook County, Chicago, DuPage.
A tipping point for businesses that want to.
And I will say this, friend, I don't pay Chicago property taxes, but your property taxes are low compared to what suburbanites. You know, I'm sick of Chicagoans bitching about their property taxes.
See, that's
taxes.
What I'm saying. Sick of.
No, but it's true.
But I'm saying.
But
other taxes in the city are comparatively high.
I'm paying those. Yeah. That's why I'm helping.
Speaking of Chicago, let's just talk about the Laquan McDonald police cover-up trial, which is underway. There's lots of moving parts here. One officer is angry that another officer reported that she said things that she said she did not, but she didn't go back and submit a correction. She let that lie. One attorney argued that the cops all handled the situation correctly that night that Laquan McDonald was shot, a point that overlooks the fact that that's not what this trial is about. It's about whether or not they falsified reports to protect Officer Van Dyke. And McDonald, to me, is still on trial here, characterized as the real lawbreaker. Eric, I know this is the trial in some ways that I think you anticipated as much as any of us. If there's an endemic or systemic problem in the police department, this is the trial
for that. Yeah, and that's what this is about. You know, this trial is not getting nearly the attention that the Jason Van Dyke trial got, but it is in some ways much more important because the Jason Van Dyke trial really focused on that 6 seconds between the time that he gets out of the car and starts shooting Laquan McDonald. This trial ostensibly is going to focus on the 6 hours, the 6 weeks, the 6 months after the shooting and what the police did and didn't do to see that justice was done and that it was a good shoot. I'm really surprised at the amount of anti-Laquan McDonald stuff that has been introduced into this trial that they have gone over. You know, you keep hearing, well, he was jaywalking and he was slashing tires and he scratched the windshield of a police car. They're putting Laquan McDonald back on trial in effect. They're rerunning the Jason Van Dyke trial. And the only reason that it's not completely an outrage is that the judge is just kind of letting it go. And they went to like 8 o'clock last night. They're just going on and on. And it seems to me that the judge is just saying, look, I'm not going to stop these defense attorneys from relitigating the entire shooting, which is what they're doing, because that might be grounds for appeal. Because the judge knows what happened.
And it's a bench trial.
Yeah, I'm saying it's a bench trial. If this were a jury trial, it would be completely outrageous.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So the judge is just letting them go, and so it doesn't seem to me to be outrageous on its face because the judge knows the situation. She's giving these guys all the room they need to go on and on about all kinds of crazy theories. One witness, the medical examiner, was reporting that Detective March called in and said that he was telling him that Laquan McDonald had lunged at Van Dyke and Walsh, And the lawyer was going, well, how do you know it was March? Like, we couldn't have been someone who was impersonating him. Like,
wow.
Yeah, like that happens. Right. I mean, after the shooting, which nobody really thought at the time was all that big a deal, like, yeah, there's going to be an imposter calling the medical examiner's office. And the judge just kind of everyone's kind of letting it go, because I think everybody trusts the judge to see through all this stuff and get to the fundamental question, which is actually all that difficult. The question is, did these guys lie? To try to cover right. up what Jason Van Dyke did,
and the answer is yes.
And the answer seems to be yes.
Seems to be yes.
It's a hard yes.
Yes.
Oh my God!
I'm trying to be fair.
This is easier than the Van Dyke trial, right? I mean, even though the video outed him, he said, "Well, my perspective was different." Blah blah blah. But there's no doubt about this.
And for those of us who I think I speak for everyone who in this room right now who support the police. There are people out there who are willing to take a bullet for you, and that's amazing. But there is also this culture that they will lie to defend their own, and hopefully that will get rid of that, or at least diminish it significantly going forward. And I don't think that hurts the police. I don't think that hurts their policing ability, and it certainly doesn't diminish my view of the job they do.
And from what I'm reading about Dora Fontaine, who is the officer who said she didn't make those statements, and then the attorneys were saying, well, you're afraid to lose your job. What kind of job could you have? I mean, going after her and saying, well, you have two homes.
It was very personal.
That's
very
insane.
Personal. She had made a phone call at work that night because she had a sick kid, apparently. And the defense attorney was going, that's the kind of police officer you are, making a personal phone call while you're on duty. It's like, geez.
Yeah, they really turned on their own here.
Yeah.
But you know, Eric's right. I mean, so that night, Van Dyke made a bad decision. A cop, in the heat of the moment, who knows why, pulled the trigger, emptied his revolver, right? But this is a completely different thing.
Yes.
This is that was one police officer in one moment. This is a culture of policing that says we will, even in that case, lie to protect him from the justice that Laquan's family deserves. Also in Chicago, I don't know that this merits much conversation, but chunks of ice are falling off the buildings and
just
hitting people.
Scott and I almost got hit on the way over here.
Almost two more job openings at the Chicago Tribune.
And that happened to me a few years ago. I got knocked down and scratched in the face by falling chunk of ice.
They just fell right behind you, John.
Stuff just fell.
Really?
Right? Yes.
Did you watch you fall off the building behind us?
Don't talk so loudly.
Well, it was that type of storm. I mean, you know, it was windy, wet, so it adhered
to
things.
And then froze, right. And now it chips off.
I drove under a viaduct that had all these like shards of ice that looked like something out of a Indiana Jones movie, and I'm like, what do I do to not be impaled by all of this? Yeah, it was terrifying.
That's what we should have done walking over here, Eric. Dun 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 dun.
The Chicago Tribune reporting today, and it's been elsewhere, that the new stoplights, the LED lights, don't warm up. So in old days, they would have melted snow and ice on them. They don't do it so much anymore. And police in Naperville say there's one intersection where there were a couple of crashes resulting from inability to see the stoplights.
It's a really strange storm. I mean, still today, some of the street signs and exit signs are completely snowed over. The ice and snow is stuck, mm-hmm. and it's hard to tell sometimes where you are. I missed an exit on Lakeshore Drive the other day. Brenda and I drive, and I go, why is that sign say Montrose? And she says, because you didn't get off at Irving right. Park. And I go, I don't think we saw an Irving Park sign.
I didn't know I was in the city until they stopped me and asked for the tax.
papers, please.
Right. We're going to get to Trump land in a second. But just since let's finish the Illinois and Chicago segment of today's pod. This is the bicentennial year for Illinois. To help celebrate its birthday in December, the State Journal Register in Springfield and the Lincoln Library have put forth a list of the 10 most unforgettable moments chosen in online voting. And before we reveal the top 5 or 10, let me just remind you how flawed and stupid online voting can be. For Time Magazine's Person of the Year, the current number one pick by online voters is BTS, the South Korean boy band. Number two is the Thai cave divers that rescued those kids. Ariana Grande is getting more online votes than Donald Trump, and Trump should not be Time's Person of the Year this year. It should be journalists, but never mind all of that. Here in Illinois, online voters say number 5, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Number 4, Lewis and Clark. They started their voyage downstate. Number 3, ending slavery. Illinois was the first state to pass the 13th Amendment. Bigger than that, number 2... Cubs win the World Series in 2016.
Much more important.
Sorry, world. And number 1, Lincoln put to rest in Springfield's Oak Ridge Cemetery. Bertrand, your thoughts, go.
I would go with Lincoln, number one, Barack Obama, number two, maybe, the first African-American president. And I think the World's Fair is getting short shrift. I mean,
yeah.
What I know from it was reading The Devil in the White City, but the world literally came to Chicago. And the buildings, there's still, you know, there's still an impact on it now on the South Side.
Patty, give me your top three.
I'm sorry, but I have to give Lincoln two. I wish I could condense them, but ending
slavery.
Yes, you can
do whatever you want.
Well, it was 80,000 people went through the Illinois Capitol to pay their respects, which is incredible when you think it was just 2 days, and where people must have come from, how they traveled to get there is astounding to me. And it, I think, pays tribute to how important he was then. Ending slavery, without Illinois, I don't know that we would have ended slavery as early as we did, because Lincoln's early life here had an impact on the rest of the history of this country. So I think that's important as well. And then I want four or five, but women voting, I think, is significant as well, because we became the first state east of the Mississippi to let women vote. And also
that's on the top 10 list.
Yes,
yeah.
So yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, you guys.
No, that's okay.
That was three.
Well, if you want to do one more.
And the nuclear age.
Scott Stantis.
I would say number one would be nuclear age, because that's...
splitting of the atom at the University of Chicago.
Yeah, that unleashed all sorts of hijinks.
Yes.
Number two would be mourning Lincoln.
Hiroshima reduced to hijinks.
And I have to have four, I'm afraid. Ending slavery.
What's with you people?
Sorry.
He's just virtue signaling.
Right.
Here.
That's
200 all.
Years.
Let's tie the World's Fair with ending slavery. The World's Fair brought people to Chicago,
yes,
and premiered the city as the world-class city that it is. And of course, ending slavery, well, it ended slavery. So
okay.
That's,
yeah, you don't need to explain that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go with Lincoln-Douglas debates as being something that's sort of associated with Illinois, particularly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know
that's
the ending of slavery
one.
Is more
it
important,
is.
But I don't think if you ask people in the rest of the country, where did slavery, the end of slavery, really begin? I don't think they would say Illinois. The Lincoln-Douglas debates were important for raising Lincoln's profile, and which ultimately led to the end of slavery. The World's Fair, I think, is clearly something associated with Chicago and Illinois. And I would put the 68 Democratic Convention, which is not
that's
on this. Top 10 list, but if people associate, you know, things around, I'm thinking of the things that make Illinois distinctive around the world, around the country, that's certainly a serious
so, and let's so, not forget the White Sox wearing shorts.
That's a good one. My Barack Obama vote was sort of the political equivalent of people who's voted for the World Series for the Cubs, because it happened during my lifetime at this time. You guys, I'm giving that too much attention, you think?
No,
I don't know. This list of 10 has Blago going to jail as number 10.
Right.
And that's...
No,
that cannot be one of the top 10 events in Illinois history.
I think the first black president of the United States is significant. Especially considering the kind of climate we're living in now, I don't know when we're going to have another black president, because I'm
God, it could be the next one.
It could be. Well, I mean, the test for me is if you just say to people, rather than we're all working off this list here that was provided to us, if you just stop someone on the street and say, name the top three things that happened in Chicago or Illinois in history, what would those be? Maybe the fire. Yeah, seriously.
Oh, fires. Yeah, no kidding.
How's that not in the top 10? I mean, the whole city.
It's not a warm fuzzy, but Blago going to jail isn't either. So I'm with you guys on that.
There's a recency effect too with that.
Yes,
right,
absolutely.
That's the thing. That's what I mean about Obama. And the
We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary, by the way, of Blago being frog marched out of his house. I think it's December 8th or 9th. So
here's my top
five.
Number one, I've put all of the Lincoln stuff together.
Okay.
So slavery, Lincoln Douglas, him being buried in Springfield. None of that happens without Lincoln. So that's number one. Number two is Obama. Number three is the atom being split. And maybe that should be higher. I mean, the atom was first split in Chicago. Number four, the Columbia Exposition. And then number five, the Cubs, because whatever.
I feel so bad for Blago.
What did you say?
He's the host. He gets five, all right?
I'm the only one.
I feel so bad for Lewis and Clark. I feel like we need to all brush up on our history
bit. Or Per Marquette came through, or Ronald Reagan. Isn't close to the list.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
He's a Eureka boy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And the White Sox wearing shorts. I think that'll be right.
Can we put the shower in the outfield with the White Sox wearing shorts? Can we do
this? Disco demolition. Yeah. Come on.
In Trump land, I don't know where to begin this week. Should we play John Mulaney's reminder that every day it's like a horse in a hospital?
It's like there's a horse loose in a hospital. I think everything's going to be okay, but I have no idea what's going to happen next. And, like, none of you know either.
Donald Trump mocked the science of climate change. Good. Threatened to pull subsidies from General Motors after they said they were closing unprofitable plants. Floats the idea of pardoning Manafort. Sent his secretaries of state and defense to mitigate our weakness on Saudi Arabia. His former attorney, Michael Cohen, now says the president had financial ties in Russia during the campaign. Trump says that's not true. One of them's lying. And the topic that's most consuming him is not those blood red Christmas trees at the White House. It's those are...
That's terrifying.
You know, sometimes you're the guy who says, come on, we're picking on things that aren't important. I don't understand the hatred for the trees.
Oh, my God, because they're blood trees.
They are the most...
It's just one hallway decorated with red trees.
This is the land of the undead.
It's not the only tree.
Imagine if Michelle Obama had done that.
I just love the article.
Seriously.
I just love the article that says, maybe Christmas isn't her thing. I mean,
it's just one hallway, right? It's just one hallway.
Whatever. It's, you know, it's... That's part of the story from the White House.
You can't complain about anyone complaining about anything else about Trump again.
I do try and sort of be the arbiter and say that's not important. But this one is. Damn it, it's Christmas.
I kind of like him, actually.
Michelle Obama. The First Lady was asked about it, and she said everybody has their own taste. This is America, and this is ours. So she kind of laughed it off.
Yeah.
It's the McCarthy-style witch hunt by the angry Mueller Democrats spending $40 million in search of a crime that everyone knows never happened. That's what the president is thinking.
I would just want to say, I think what happened this week with Manafort, who was going to get a break because he was cooperating with prosecutors, suddenly they turned at him and said that he's been lying to them. They're pulling the deal off the table. That's a huge development, because now when they're going to sentencing, Mueller can dump all this stuff into his sentencing memo. That if he had put this in his actual report and sent it off to the Department of Justice, where they might have easily have squashed it or tried to hide it, this is going to be in open court. We're going to see a lot of information coming into that particular filing that there's no way they're going to be able to stop. You know, that train has already left
the
station. So that's
going to be public.
And I think it's huge, a huge development that because we are just slow. We're finding out in drips and drabs what Mueller has. And he's got a lot more than what we know.
Well, I think the Cohen thing is huge. You know, now we have Cohen saying that, you know, candidate Trump was saying through, you know, I had no ties with Russia, I have no business with Russia. Now you've got Cohen saying that through June of 2016, so almost up to convention time, they were still pursuing a Trump Tower in Russia.
That's
motivation for cooperation. And Trump today outside the White House said, well, look, I was running my business. I might have lost. If I had lost, it would have been good for my business to have this.
But he was
saying. So he kind of copped, even though he said Cohen was lying, he sort of copped to how smart it would have been doing to continue to pursue it.
He never denied it under oath. Trump. I mean, Trump said he didn't have business ties in Russia.
Yeah. Right.
Right. He said he was just covering his bets, apparently.
I sure want to see his answer to those questions and the style or the phraseology that he used.
Oh, lawyers.
I mean, you think so?
Because, he wrote him himself.
Yeah. Said, well, I'll tell you what.
He knows the best words.
What was the memo that they put out about Saudi Arabia? The world is a dangerous place! Exclamation point. That had Trump's imprint on it. That was a Trump memo to the world. And I'm just wondering if, even though the lawyers might have combed it, if it feels and sounds like a Donald Trump answer with exclamation points, and I hope they are very Trumpian.
That's a stupid question, Mr. Mueller.
Right. Well, I know, that's it.
you're angry Democrats.
Right. This is a stupid witch hunt, blah, blah, blah. And then finally, you know, I didn't do it.
Well, the favorite part about the tweet is when he tweeted today that this is a witch hunt. First of all, he says it's a fake witch hunt, which makes you think,
what?
Does he think there's a real witch hunt? Because, wow. But he also went on...
what is it? If you drown, you're innocent. If you survive, if you drown, you're innocent. If you survive, you're guilty.
A witch, and then we burn you to death.
Then they kill you.
Yes.
So, but he said about the investigation. It's an investigation in search of a crime. But how many convictions has it had so far? Because if it is an investigation in search of a crime, found him.
Right.
So many witches.
A gazillion. Yeah, but it's not him. It's still. I mean, don't you all agree that there's still more than one step between everything? Papadopoulos, is he in jail today?
Yes.
A two-week sentence?
For a couple weeks.
So Papadopoulos is not Donald Trump, and there's still too many
steps. But that's how, like, Watergate came down. You got Holderman, you got Ehrlichman, got Dean, you got all these guys, Butterfield, you got all these guys, and then the president's left standing.
It's like saying, John, you're going to walk to Milwaukee, and then halfway there you're in Waukegan, and you say, well, you're not in Milwaukee yet. Well, no, because I'm not done yet. I'm going to get to Milwaukee.
I'm just saying, don't do a victory dance yet if you want to see.
No, absolutely right.
Eric Zorn, you're being suspiciously quiet over there.
I feel like I'm yakking the whole time.
What are you hiding?
Some of those are the voices
in your head. I have no business ties with Russia.
I don't know who would say such a thing. No, I mean, this seems like a really pivotal week. Every week every week is brings all these new developments. This seems particularly important with what happened this morning with Cohen, with what happened earlier in the week with Manafort.
And I think the timing with when he submitted his take-home test of the questions, right? I think that it seems as though Mueller knew what to do.
Well, yeah, you didn't even talk about the fact that Manafort's lawyers apparently were cooperating with White House lawyers.
Two other quick points here so that we'll have them on the record. But speaking of timing, it was, Thanksgiving Day or the day after Thanksgiving that they released the climate report that the president wasn't that interested in.
Was that just last week?
It really was. And Ro Khan described a lot of what's happening in the Trump administration as playing soft defense. That is, you don't have to fight everything, just throw something else into the mix along the way. And another example of that this week was Ivanka Trump's email situation. How much attention has that been getting? Hillary's email situation, which was similar enough, is why Donald Trump is president. And you don't even have time to chew on that because now you've got Cohen and now you've got Manafort.
And the climate report is going, and when we look back on the last few months of 2018, that climate report is going to loom large. It's like we don't have any time to devote to it, to talk about it, to think about it. It's just, and Trump has no will to do anything about it. There's some great tweets this week, one from Neil deGrasse Tyson pointing out that we just landed this probe on Mars. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a moving platform. We shoot something however many millions of miles, hundreds of millions of miles, to hit another moving target that's rotating, and we land it like boom. And so science does this, and yet they don't want to believe us about climate change. So
here's two calls.
Hey, Rascals. My commute home from work every day is about 60 minutes. But your guys' pod is only about 40. Any way that you could do a little bit longer podcast and get me all the way home? Thanks.
You laugh.
That's nice. No,
it does
that's
not.
Nice.
The length of it typically doesn't match a commute home from work in Chicago. And then they got to search for something else. Better that we go an extra 10 minutes. Better we all get started 10 minutes earlier. But let's all endeavor to keep the content fresh, but give them as much as we possibly can. You go on board with that,
or
Eric?
Talk slower. I would love to talk. I would love to talk longer. I really would. Scott and I had to dodge falling ice on the way over here, and we were late today. We apologize.
There's a pedway connecting our buildings. What are you talking about?
There is.
Okay, two others from our listeners. The Mississippi runoff election. Thoughts?
Well, Mississippi going to Mississippi.
last in education, last in morality.
Out of wedlock pregnancies, so there's that.
Stop that, you guys. Sorry. You get to vote for whoever you want.
Yes.
And if you're worried about the mental or political health of the country, 40 seats now in the House. So, I mean, Eric wrote eloquently this week and sort of backtracked on the fact that if you want to talk about what happened at the midterm, there is a signal sent. It was a blue wave, right?
Yeah, but they won the Democrats won the congressional vote by 8.1%, which is bigger than the 2010 Tea Party wave by 2%. That was about a 6% wave. This is an 8% wave. And the fact that you didn't see it as much because of the way the Senate turned out, but the Senate map was so bad for the Democrats that it didn't turn out well for them. But they actually won more Senate seats than the Republicans did. If you look at all the races that were up, the swing in votes was. Was it two seats, I think, now? The Republicans have 53, so 53-47, which means they're going to have, it's going to be a little easier for them to get things through.
I think it's 53-47. I'm pretty sure that's the margin.
I think you're right.
And one last thing. This listener wants our thoughts on uniformity of elections.
Hey, Rascals. This is Bill in Ohio, and we just went through a whole bunch of recounts and certifications of elections and all that other hoo-ha, and I'm just wondering if the Rascals think there should be some set of national standards for our elections. I'd really like to hear your answer. Thank you.
I think it's a great idea. Go ahead, Scott.
I was actually going to agree with you. I'm not sure, and maybe some of our listeners can tell me why, and it's sstandis@chicagotribune.com, because I don't know the answer to this. Why isn't it uniform? Every other country I've been to, and I've talked to cartoonists in Australia and Europe, they have, you know, if you vote in Brisbane, it's the same as voting in Melbourne. It's the same mechanisms, the same machines, same county. Why did the federal government allow the states to make these decisions? And the only thing that comes to mind is that Jim Crow was very powerful, mm-hmm. and that this allowed southern states in particular to disenfranchise voters.
Or that states are sovereign. I thought you answered it with your question. Why did the federal government allow the states to do it? Because it's a states' rights issue. Maybe but it should be a local state, issue.
The federal government for federal elections has right. control. You can say, okay, this is how presidential elections have to run. You have to have this amount of early voting. You have to have this
That's
many.
True.
You,
yeah.
you
right.
have to have this kind of registration procedure, this kind of petition
but
challenging.
I think even that varies from state right. to state.
It does, but it shouldn't. The federal government has that right to do that for Senate, for Congress, and right. for the presidency. And once you do that, once you impose all these standards, then you're not, the states are not going to go freelance on their municipal elections.
And I think that this is where the fight happens with states' rights, but in terms of civil liberties and civil rights, this, I think, fits very comfortably into that definition.
It's time for our recommendations. These are things that we are eating, drinking, listening to, watching, reading. Patty is making all sorts of interesting animated faces. You all right over there?
Trying to go through everything that I'm doing. What am I reading? What am I eating? Yes, go ahead.
By the way, how did that McDonald's audition go?
It was fine. You could see from the animated faces, all I had to do was react to getting fast food in the drive-thru. So.
She auditioned for a part in a TV commercial where she's the woman getting the fast food through
the
drive window.
Yes.
For McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
What did you order?
I ordered the number 6 with the coffee.
Do you know what the number 6 is?
I have no idea. Right. I think it's the chicken sandwich, but I'm not positive.
And it wasn't a speaking part, but she then needed to sort of react all flustered and discombobulated.
Yes, reaching for my money. Because I'm surprised at how quickly the food arrives.
I just think it's weird that you'd get coffee with a chicken sandwich. But
it seemed wrong.
Yeah.
It did. But
I don't think that the talent needs to tell the director, right?
No.
You just like go. You just do what they say.
I did an audition one time, and they told me what the total was. It was another sort of commercial, and I realized later I'd done the change wrong. I was like, I hope I didn't lose that audition because I said 38 cents instead of 39.
You have a very animated face. We were just witnessing some of that. Yes. All right, Steve, what are you reading, watching, listening to?
So I just read a book not too long ago called Crooked Heart, and I just lost it. Doggone it. I'm sorry, you guys. It's a novel. It's probably a couple of years old. I found it in the book club section, of the library.
Wow.
But it's by Lissa Evans, and it's about this young boy. It really could be a movie. It's about a young boy. He's 8 or 10, very intelligent, raised by his godmother in the days just before World War II. The godmother dies, and then he's one of the children moved out of London. And he gets moved into this house with this woman and her family, and she's barely on the right side of the law. In fact, not always. So she kind of abuses him, not physically, but uses him for different things. And so there develops this relationship between this young, super smart boy and this 20 or 30-year-old sort of dim-witted mom, and how they help each other. And it was really a nice read, and it's called Crooked Heart, if you're interested in a World War II novel set in London.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I really liked it.
Excellent. I am rereading a book by Anne Lamott called Bird by Bird, and it's about sitting down through the process of writing and why you write, and basically getting your butt back in the seat, not knocking yourself down because you didn't write the great American novel yet, or that everything that comes out of your pen or out of your mind isn't brilliant. It's just like one thing at a time. Just write this much. Don't think you have to write an entire scene. Just look through that square, like even a picture frame of what that thing is, what you want to describe. So
I've been reading Michelle Obama's Becoming and sharing it with our listeners, and she's a good writer. I'm hopeful that she wrote it. It sure sounds like her, but I'm not sure exactly what she sounds like, but it feels and sounds like I think Michelle Obama is. The prose is terrific, and the story is very, very interesting.
Maybe she read Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott.
No kidding. I mean, that's sure what made me think about that. So my recommendation this week is Becoming by Michelle Obama.
Excellent.
Scott, what do you like this
week? I'm going to get very personal here. We were offered buyouts at the Chicago Tribune. And to be completely honest, my wife and I considered them very, very, very seriously. We decided against it.
Oh,
but
that's a cliffhanger.
But what it did, and here's where my recommendation is, I thought that this Friday would be my last day. There's a very high likelihood. It wasn't. But it made me walk through Chicago, and I live down here in the Loop, and see the city as if I was seeing it for the last time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not dying. Because
it's lovely, though, but it's lovely.
It is beautiful. Do yourself a favor. Try to get into that mindset and see this place for the first time, or convince yourself you're seeing it for the last time. And how absolutely stunningly beautiful this city is.
I wish I had my violin with me.
No, I did the same thing. When I came back from London, I realized how wonderful my city is, and I looked at it like a tourist. Anyway, I didn't mean
And I'm really glad Scott's sticking around, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Amen. Woo, 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 woo.
Brilliant cartoonist.
Thank you.
I agree with him sometimes.
Eric Storn,
go. Recommendation, 30 seconds. Oh, that's right. And here, and Eric wants you to submit your recommendation, you, the listener, and here's how Eric submitted his.
This is Eric Zorn from the Northwest Side. My recommendation is Lena Dunham Comes to Terms with Herself, a 7,000-word profile by New York Magazine writer Allison P. Davis that gives us an intimate and in some ways sad look at the roller coaster life of a 32-year-old writer, actor, director, who inspires mixed emotions in many of us, but is undeniably a major voice in her generation. That's Lena Dunham Comes to Terms with Herself at New York Magazine Online.
That's this week's podcast. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. Thank you, Patty V.
Thank you.
Scott Stannis, Eric Zorn, The Mincing Rascals are produced by Elif Garris. Remember, send us your voice memos. We'll include them in the broadcast podcast. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to The Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.